From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, sitting in for Terry Gross. The hit off-Broadway rock musical Hedwig and the Angry Inch is now a new movie. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with writer, director, and star John Cameron Mitchell. Also, Christopher Guest on making improvised mockumentaries that are more affectionate than biting, or both in the case of Best in Show about professional dog shows. Guest is best known for his role as the lead singer in Spinal Tap. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the band The Yehus, and book critic Maureen Corrigan looks at the latest novel by John Irving. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The Bush administration signaled the U.S. is prepared to stand apart from the rest of the world on global warming. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice says ultimately America may have to go it alone on the issue. Negotiators from 178 nations today agreed on how to enforce legally binding sanctions against violators of the Kyoto Treaty. The treaty seeks to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. President Bush still rejects the treaty as fatally flawed. Rice said the administration is working on its own set of proposals to cut greenhouse gases. Indonesia has a new president. Lawmakers today named Megawati Sukarnoputri the country's new leader after dismissing her predecessor. NPR's Michael Sullivan reports from Jakarta.
Megawati Sukarnoputri, daughter of Indonesia's founding father Sukarno, became the country's fifth president since independence after the People's Consultative Assembly today removed Abdurrahman Wahid from office for incompetence. In a last-ditch effort to stay in power, Wahid had, early on Monday, attempted to stop the impeachment vote against him. He announced he had suspended the People's Consultative Assembly just hours before it was scheduled to vote and ordered the Indonesian police to prevent lawmakers from convening the session. But the police refused. The session went ahead, and late in the afternoon, Wahid was removed. Shortly after taking the oath of office, Megawati urged all Indonesians to accept the assembly's decision. She said she would begin the process of naming a new cabinet in the next few days. Michael Sullivan, NPR News, Jakarta.
Pulitzer Prize-winning author Eudora Welty has died. The Mississippi native was 92 years old. Teresa Collier with Public Radio in Mississippi has this report.
Eudora Welty, the award-winning novelist and short story writer, died Monday afternoon in her hometown of Jackson in a local hospital. Welty suffered from pneumonia and had been ill for some time. Eudora Welty's celebrated career began in 1936 with the publication of her first short story, Death of a Traveling Salesman. Her 1972 novel, The Optimist's Daughter, earned a Pulitzer Prize for fiction in 1973. Welty was considered by many to be one of America's greatest writers. She received 10 Lifetime Achievement Awards, including one from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Welty has been recognized by many heads of state. She was knighted by France in 1987. For NPR News, I'm Teresa Collier in Jackson, Mississippi.
A federal appeals court today refused to permit the Commerce Department to relax the standards for labeling dolphin-safe tuna. The government wanted to change the standards under a 1997 law aimed at appeasing Mexico. The Bush administration said today it's studying the appeals court ruling and would consider an appeal. Stock prices were lower on Wall Street today. The Dow Jones Industrials off 152 points at 10,424, and the Nasdaq was down 40 at 1988. You're listening to NPR News. Israeli officials say they've intercepted and killed a Palestinian who is planning another suicide bombing. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports.
A spokesman for Prime Minister Ariel Sharon says the man was the partner of another suspected militant seized Sunday in Haifa. In that operation, Israeli TV accompanied police as the man led them to an apartment where he kept an explosive device, then showed the spot where he allegedly planned to blow himself up. Roadblocks and other security measures remained in place in Haifa through Monday. Officials say they're preparing for revenge attacks after Jewish militants last week gunned down a Palestinian family, killing three members, including a three-month-old infant. Authorities believe the same extremist group of Jewish settlers is responsible for several other attacks. Police have called in two known extremists for questioning, but both said they would refuse to appear. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Cleanup crews in Baltimore pulled the last smoldering rail car out of a downtown tunnel today. Derailment of the 60-car CSX freight train last Wednesday had all but shut down a large section of the city. The fire was declared under control today after the last car was dragged from the tunnel. Rail traffic is not expected to resume for days and possibly weeks as repairs are made to the East Coast rail artery. Louisiana officials have lifted an evacuation order. That's days after a barge loaded with flammable gas hit a bridge across the Intracoastal Highway. About 350 people had been kept from their homes and 650 from their jobs since early Thursday. Workers dislodged the vessel and moved it over the weekend. They also made repairs to the bridge. I'm Frank Stasio, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, bringing NovaSoy brand isoflavones to consumers throughout the United States on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, in for Terry Gross.
Don't you know me, Kansas City? I'm the new Berlin Wall. Try and tear me down. I was born on the other side.
That's John Cameron Mitchell in the character of Hedvig, the transsexual glam rock chanteuse he created for the New York stage, and whom Mitchell now plays in the movie adaptation he also wrote and directed. Rolling Stone called the original Hedvig and the Angry Inch the first rock musical that truly rocks. The film won a Best Director Award and an Audience Award at Sundance. Hedvig's story goes something like this. When she's born in communist East Berlin, she's a he named Hansel. Hansel eventually falls in love with an American GI who offers to marry him and take him to the United States if he gets a sex change operation. Hansel reluctantly agrees, but the operation is botched. All that remains of his genitalia is an unrecognizable bit, which Hansel, now Hedvig, calls the Angry Inch. She's abandoned by her GI and ends up in a trailer park in Kansas. There she starts writing songs and performing them with a band in a chain of family restaurants called Bilgewater's. Hedvig mixes campy patter with bitter stories about the life that got away, and about her search for someone to make her feel complete. It's a quest inspired by Plato's story about the origin of love.
When the earth was still flat, and clouds made of fire, and mountains stretched up to the sky, sometimes higher. Folks roamed the earth like big rolling kegs. They had two sets of arms, they had two sets of legs, they had two faces peering out of one giant head, so they could watch all around them as they talked while they read. And they never knew nothing of love, it was before.
John Cameron Mitchell, thank you for coming on Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
So for people who haven't seen the play and haven't seen the movie yet, who is Hedvig?
Hedvig, you can say Hedwig or Hedvig. The name came from Ibsen's Hedvig in The Wild Duck, who is the girl that was destroyed by too much honesty. But originally was inspired by this woman that was a German army wife. My dad was a general in Kansas when I was 14, and she was my brother's babysitter, I think. Someone else thought she might have been my cleaning lady. I can't really remember, but she was around a lot, and my friend Brenda and I would go to her trailer, and we realized she had all these, you know, like a different date every day, and you know, she wasn't even that good looking, and there was something going on. And only years later, we realized she was probably a prostitute. And she was our friend, and she'd give us drinks, and we would sing for her. And she was kind of the very broad inspiration for Hedvig.
So after you had this initial idea, you hooked up with Stephen Trask and his band Cheater, and you worked on Hedvig from there. Where'd it go from there?
Well, that's when we started working at the drag rock club, Squeeze Box, where Stephen was the musical director. And I'd never done drag, I'd never done rock, but I knew I wanted it to be very rock and roll piece, so we kept it in clubs for a while. And it became so popular, the character, that she became the main character. And it was sort of the combination of the origin of love myth, which had a lot to do with the division of self and the drag club, which was so much about this divide of gender and this fluidity of gender. And I mixed in a bit of my dad's background as the commandant of the U.S. sector of Berlin right before the wall came down. So this divided city was also in the mix, too.
At first impression, what is Hedwig to look at when you first see Hedwig?
She's got a big blonde Farrah Fawcett-inspired wig. You know, her fabrics of choice are acid-washed denim and bright colors, and she's some of the, you know, perhaps colors and fabrics you saw coming flooding over the wall in 1989.
And while Hansel's growing up, he's really lonely, and he sort of finds his friends in American glam rock. I think you call them the crypto homos.
Yeah, well, he listens to radio, and Bowie and Iggy and Lou Reed are right up there as much as, you know, Tony Tennille and Anne Murray. And we think of her very much as a patchwork person, you know, an exquisite corpse. There's a song called Exquisite Corpse, which comes from the surrealist artist's game of one artist would draw the head, another would draw the torso, and another would draw the legs. And they just sort of see what they ended up with at the end. And she is certainly, you know, ending up looking different than she originally imagined.
What does it mean to the character that Hedwig Hansel was sort of coerced, forced into this sex change operation?
Well, the whole thing is a little bit of a fairy tale. So the kid's name is Hansel originally, you know, and there's this idea of Hansel and Gretel running away from home, and there's any kind of semblance of power is kind of wrested away in order to be free. I mean, actually showing it in Berlin was really interesting, because especially Easterners really picked up on, you know, the idea of the promise of freedom, and then suddenly the wall comes down and, you know, you're screwed suddenly. You know, Hedwig is, you know, metaphorically, you know, emasculated and, you know, when masculation is equated with power, and forced to identify himself as a woman. It's not really a transsexual's story of a coming of age. It's really a disempowerment in his case.
I'm Peter Clowney, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is John Cameron Mitchell, writer, director, and star of the film Hedwig and the Angry Inch. He also wrote and starred in the off-Broadway musical on which he based the film. I think, well, let me ask you this. I mean, you said you wanted to make a movie musical unlike most that you'd ever seen, but possibly like the stuff that you've seen by Bob Fosse, Bob Fosse's movies being things like All That Jazz or Cabaret. So what is it that you wanted to take from him?
Fosse, I remember seeing All That Jazz in high school and then later Cabaret, and I just loved the sense of reality. You know, this wasn't Singing in the Rain where, you know, you're not in the real world. All That Jazz really freed me up when I realized that when there's a really strong central character, each scene can almost have its own style. If you're establishing that it's seen primarily through that main character's eyes. And each scene in Hedwig has its own style. You know, one scene is all close-ups, one scene is a lot of animation, another might be highly realistic, you know, one camera, handheld. Some of the songs are traditional fantasy numbers, like at the end of All That Jazz, sort of happening in his head. And other scenes are motivated in scene, such as, you know, like something like Nashville, where they're performing in that space. I thought about how real that felt, and wanted to do a lot of the vocals live, shoot them live for the camera. Which is what I did for about half of the songs in Hedwig, which requires multiple cameras so you can edit well, which makes it a little more expensive, but, you know, then you don't have to lip-sync the punk rock.
Well, one thing about the Bob Fosse movies that I was thinking about, in All That Jazz, there's a lot of huge spectacle, but it's often in the service of something very sad or uncomfortable, you know, something that's that really pulls on the audience rather than being a kind of a release. And I see that in Hedwig, too. I mean, there's a song from the show called Wig in a Box that mm-hmm. becomes this kind of spun out trailer park spectacle in the movie, mm-hmm. much bigger than it could possibly be in a theater. And I think it serves the motion of the song to push it out that way, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, that certainly has a melancholy underneath. She starts the song at the lowest point in her life and probably ends it, you know, on one of the highest points of her life. And that's probably the biggest production number. It was kind of shot moment to moment. You know, we knew we'd end up with the trailer exploding, you know, and becoming a stage, which is what happens at the end because that's something you have to prepare. But even that came out of a certain spontaneity. I wanted the whole trailer to actually just blow up, and, you know, our budget, my production designer was like, I can give you one wall coming down. And we were like, well, I guess it really should be a wall becoming a stage, you know.
I want to play some of the song Wing in a Box. Let's listen to that.
On nights like this, when the world's a bit amiss and the lights go down across the trailer park, I get down, I feel at, feel on the verge of going mad, and then it's time to punch the clock. I put on some makeup, turn on the tape deck, and put the wig back on my head. Suddenly I'm Miss Midwest Midnight Checkout Queen, until I head home and I put myself to bed. Suddenly routine. I look up from my vermouth on the rocks, a gift wrapped wig still in the box of towering velveteen. I put on some.
That's Wig in a Box from Hedwig and the Angry Inch. We'll be back with John Cameron Mitchell, writer, director, and star of the film, after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, filling in for Terry Gross. My guest is John Cameron Mitchell, writer, director, and star of the film Hedwig and the Angry Inch. I know you went to a whole lot of different schools because you were kind of an army brat. So what was your high school experience like, and how does that come through Hedwig?
Well, the beginning of high school was in St. Xavier in Junction City, Kansas. We were at Fort Riley, the army base nearby. And there was no theater. It was like the school, there were two high schools, public and that one, and everybody who got kicked out of the public had to go to the Catholic high school. So it was highly mixed. It was the unwed mothers, it was the, you know, the Mexican immigrants, it was the Irish families, it was the general's son, it was, you know, my girlfriend in junior high was a black girl, and she turned me on to, you know, Parliament Funkadelic, and it was a really, really mixed, fun place, but, you know, there were like 12 people in our classes, you know, in our entire senior class. And no theater, there was no money. It was only money for sports because it was a Catholic school, after all. Then we went to Albuquerque where there was a little bit of theater, but again, a Catholic school, so the drama teacher, Miss Heron, who directed me in a Pinter play, you know, in junior class, you know, gave up because she just hated the principal, and there was no theater again, so I had to get my mom to direct something. And, you know, the talent show, I had to choreograph something, you know, an interpretive dance to a Fleetwood Mac song, and these were things that I just felt I had to do.
What Fleetwood Mac song was it?
It was Sisters of the Moon. Of course, Stevie Nicks was singing it, and the performance involved a slow-motion crucifixion and scourging. I mean, it was a Catholic school, so we had to have some sort of a nod. And we didn't win. The girl who sang the theme from Arthur and played the flute won. But, you know, Hedwig never won either, so it's all sort of a piece. And I was very Catholic as a kid, you know, I was very religious. And some of Tommy Gnosis, who's Hedwig's lover, who becomes the rock star, his religiousness sort of comes out of my experience. And his name Gnosis comes from the Gnostic Gospels, which he interprets, you know, the Genesis myth of Adam and Eve, that Eve is the knowledge giver and was sort of the cool one in the equation. And that's a very Gnostic view of Genesis. So there's a little bit of Plato, a little bit of Gnostics, a little bit of Socrates in there. You know, if it was on the internet, you could, you know, have a hyper click there and go to the Gnostics.
Have you ever had anyone look at Hedwig and then find out that you were raised strict Catholic and say, "Oh, figures"?
Probably. I mean, you know, Hedwig does have all the marks of the Catholic girl. You know what they say about Catholic girls. She's certainly a rebel. Actually, I went back to my boarding school, and I went to boarding school when I was 10 in Scotland, Benedictine boys' school, and I went back to the priest there, who I realized, of course, was a giant queen only in my adulthood. And I said, you know, I've become an actor. And he said, well, I'm not surprised. So I think it's the people who were there who aren't surprised more than those who might not have been there. I was in San Francisco, and someone ran up to me at a screening and said, I'm your ex-girlfriend's sister from Junction City, Kansas, and she just wanted me to tell you that she just saw Hedwig in Kansas City in a screening, and she went with her girlfriend, and they loved it. So, you know, it all comes around at the end.
When you realized you were gay and decided you really had to come out, what was that like? Was it traumatic? Did it happen over a long time?
Oh, it happened over a long time, and it was the 70s, so I wasn't really, there were no real role models, but I was, you know, reading John Ritchie and William Burroughs and such, and it seemed very sort of scary thing, but I knew eventually I'd come out once I felt more comfortable, and I got away from home and the military and the Catholic thing and slowly, you know, traveled the world and realized it was there was all kinds of people around. And senior year of college at Northwestern, I came out and traveled across Europe, and it was scary too because it was the beginning of AIDS as a very visible thing, and so it felt very political in a way to come out too, and it was a serious thing, but it was also very, you know, changed everything. It, you know, gave me all kinds of confidence. It made me able to do things I had never done before. Even physically, I felt more coordinated, more relaxed. You know, I was able to get into all kinds of music, and punk rock suddenly appeared, and it's funny what something like that can do.
It's like a passport to something.
Yeah, and actually it happened in San Francisco when I was visiting my brother at college in his frat, and I sort of had to get away and met a guy who was an auto mechanic, and he drove me away on the back of his motorcycle to Berkeley, and I disappeared for the weekend. And I came back to my brother, and he's like, where were you? And who are you? He knew something had happened, something had changed, and it was very exciting.
So now that Hedwig is wrapped and the film is opening, what are you going to work on next? What's next for you?
Well, I've been working in the interim when Hedwig wasn't happening on a children's story for film, which is I'm writing with a guy named Julian Koster, who is involved with some bands down in Athens, Georgia. It's a collective of bands called Elephant Six. And his stuff is very childlike, but in the more European, you know, Roald Dahl, J.M. Barrie children's story, where language is very important and sound and music are very important. And That's called The Grandma Phone. You know, it's about this, well, it's a complicated story. But working on that, it'll be a, sort of a dark, you know, probably kind of big budget children's film because it has a lot of animation in it. And I don't know if I'll ever get the money unless Hedwig does well, but that's okay. And then there's something else that I'm just, you know, bouncing around in my head that it'll be a much smaller thing, probably in video, that all I know that is that it will make you laugh and it will make you cry and it will have tons of explicit sex. And it would be, you know, not like some of these French films lately, because it will be good sex. It won't be bad, alienated, degrading French sex. So that will probably involve workshopping with actors for a long time. You know, maybe the actors will have to be, you know, lovers. I don't know if, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, or two boyfriends, two girlfriends. I'm not sure yet. All I know is that the sex, you know, might be the beginning and the whole relationship, you know, and the sex, how it develops through a relationship. But it'll be a real story, and it'll be somewhat improvisationally acted and
why do you want to do that? Why do you want to do
that? Well, I haven't seen sex used in that way. I've seen it used as shock value in art films, and it's never erotic. You know, it seems to, and I actually am sort of interested in really good porn films that almost move into narrative and into move into a place that's very moving and very funny, because as we all know, sex can be very funny, can be very moving, it can be very boring, it can be degrading, and it can be highly satisfying. But just something like really, something I really haven't seen.
Well, John Cameron Mitchell, I really want to thank you for coming on Fresh Air.
You're welcome.
John Cameron Mitchell is the writer, director, and star of the new film Hedwig and the Angry Inch, based on his hit off-Broadway rock musical. I'm Peter Clowney, and this is Fresh Air.
My sex change operation got botched. My guardian angel fell asleep on the watch. Now all I've got is a Barbie doll crotch. I've got an angry inch. 6 inches, 4 and 5 inches back. I got an angry inch. 6 inches, 4 and 5 inches back. I got an angry inch. I'm from the land where you still hear the cries. I had to get out after several ties. I changed my name and assumed the disguise. I got an angry itch. 6 inches, 4 and 5 inches back. I got an angry itch.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, promoting excellence in journalism worldwide and investing in the vitality of 26 U.S. communities. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, from Spinal Tap to Best in Show, a talk with Christopher Guest about making mockumentaries. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the debut album by the band The Yehoos, and Maureen Corrigan reviews The Fourth Hand, John Irving's new novel.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, sitting in for Terry Gross. It's standard practice for rock musicians to cover songs by other acts they admire, adding their own twist to them. Rock critic Ken Tucker says that sometimes these interpretations can be as entertaining as the originals, and he's found a new example on the debut album by a group called the Yehoos.
The Yehoos, that's spelled Y-A-Y-H-O-O-S, are a bunch of Yahoos whom you may or may not know individually. Singer Dan Baird used to lead the Georgia Satellites. You might remember their radio hit, Keep Your Hands to Yourself. Guitarist and producer Eric Amble has played in the bands of everyone from Joan Jett to Steve Earle to, currently, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. The other two guys, Terry Anderson and Keith Christopher, have been around a lot, too. I love the name of these guys' CD. It's called Fear Not the Obvious, if for no other reason than it fesses up to their strategy. Never strain to come up with a new riff if you can rip off a good one from someone else. That's Keith Christopher of the Yehoos getting in touch with his Rod Stewart in the Faces side on his own composition For Crying Out Loud. But really, didn't that sound like the best Faces outtake you never heard? Sometimes the Yehoos are all too true to their name, tossing off tunes that sound as if they were written on stage during a performance fueled by a few too many beers. Yehoos wrap up their sloppy, happy party with a particularly nice surprise. These hard rockers lean into, of all things, ABBA's 1977 hit Dancing Queen. Yes, it's partly played for laughs and surprise, but there's also something very sweet, even moving, about the obvious affection they have for the song's great hook and open-hearted emotion. I don't know whether we'll ever get another CD from the Yehoos. It has the feel of a one-off project. But if they existed for no other reason than to cover one song by ABBA, they've done America proud.
You can dance, you can jive, having the time of your life. Oh, see that girl, watch.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Fear Not the Obvious by the Yahoos. Coming up, Christopher Guest on making mockumentaries. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Peter Clowney, sitting in for Terry Gross.
Do you feel that in collaboration with David, that you are afforded the opportunity to express yourself musically the way you would like to?
Well, I think I do, you know, in my solos. Yeah. My solos are my trademark.
That's Christopher Guest as lead guitarist Nigel Tufnell in Rob Reiner's 1984 mock rockumentary, This is Spinal Tap. Guest has a gift for inventing hilarious and utterly believable characters. When Guest co-wrote the 1996 film Waiting for Guffman, he gave himself the part of Corky St. Clair, a flamboyant producer banned from New York after his live-action version of the Fireman movie Backdraft burnt the venue to the ground. For 2000's Best in Show, Guest created Harlan Pepper, a backcountry hound dog lover who's convinced his pet has what it takes to win the Mayflower Kennel Club dog show.
My father was a coonhound man. He had red bones, and his brother had a blue tick, and his brother had a plot hound, and some other members of the family, some various cousins, they have a Stephen Stock, some other kind of Cataluna hounds. And my brother Otto also had a red bone. We used to fight all the time. He used to say, "I'm a red bone man." I used to say, "I'm a bloodhound man." The bloodhound of all the breeds is just such a noble, loyal, perfect dog. I mean, you can't find a better dog on the whole planet Earth. And I would guess that even if one day they land on some other planet in Venus or Mars, or heaven, you couldn't find a better dog. And Hubert is the best hound I've ever had. I've had probably 10 or 15. He is not only a great show dog, but he could be a great man trail dog. If the police ever came and said, "I need a great bloodhound," he would be the one to take out. Because if there was some kind of convict loose, you know, God forbid, he'd be the one to find them.
Christopher Guest spoke on stage earlier this summer during the New Yorker Festival. He was interviewed by Susan Orlean, a staff writer for the New Yorker and author of The Bullfighter Checks Her Makeup, My Encounters with Ordinary People, a collection of stories which was released this year. She asked Christopher Guest about the world of competitive dog shows.
The real world is way, way stranger than what we depicted. Mm-hmm. And I thought that if we had, some of the stories I heard were, if you'd seen them in a film, you would have said, this is ridiculous, this goes just too far. There were stories about people at the larger competitions sabotaging the other dogs. It is a frequent thing that happens where people will go around with scissors into the grooming area and while no one's looking just clip off a piece of, you know, enough hair so that it's basically the dog can't win. And it's really cutthroat. It's very, very serious. And there are other more personal stories I heard that are scary. I try to find a balance between the reality that I observe and then obviously it has to be funny, but you're right that if there's no affection for these people, and they may not be the most intelligent or talented people, but if you don't have affection for them, then there really is no point in doing the movie, because it's, I think after 5 or 10 minutes you'd be bored with that slant, you know.
Do you ever find when you're editing a film that there are places where it's gone too far?
No. I don't, because that's in the hands of the actors. Mm-hmm. And to preface this by explaining how the films are done, and we don't do these in a conventional way. I write typically with Eugene Levy for 6 months, come up with a story which then becomes an outline which may be 15 or 20 pages. Mm-hmm. That is broken down into perhaps 75 scenes. where we know exactly what happens in every scene, and there's a beginning and a middle and end, and then I talk to the actors, but there's no dialogue written down of any kind, and there's no rehearsal. So when we shoot, that's you're seeing many times the first time what these people are saying. And the actors have to be the best at this talent, really, that there can be, because this is you're out on a limb. It's really akin to playing jazz, where there's a song has been written. You know what key you're playing in. You listen to the changes, and you follow. And then you know not to take a solo when someone else is playing. You lay back, and these are
where the story it has.
Everyone knows the story. They know the backstory. They know the point of every scene. They know who they are. There's no contradiction in who, in terms of relationships, in terms of facts. So they're not contradicting each other. And the camera turns on.
It's amazing.
And then you run out of film, and the camera turns off, and you reload, and you keep going. I didn't mean that facetiously, because in most cases the scene is written, and it may be typically 2 minutes or so, and you shoot the scene, and then you break for sometimes an hour or two, and you relight. This is, I have a headset when I'm not in a scene, and I'm talking to the cameraman, and I'm directing it as if it's a live show, where I'm telling him to move in and out, and then we may do it twice, sometimes at the most maybe three times, and then we move on to the next scene. Again, it's the backbone of this is a story that has to be very well understood, but it's given over to the performers, and they're exceptionally good at this. It's a very difficult thing, because it's not improv in the sense of going out to a comedy club improv, where the intention is basically to make you laugh. Mm-hmm. And this is slightly more dimensional, because it has to feel real, because it's in the format of a documentary.
What part of the process do you enjoy the most?
I like this. This is my favorite part. I do like it all, I have to say. I like it all. I like editing a lot. And in a film like this last one and in Waiting for Guffman, we had 60 hours of film. And that gets cut down to sometimes under 90 minutes. And that takes close to a year. 10 hours a day. There is no, in a conventional film, there's a cut being put together by the editor while you're shooting. So when you finish shooting, you basically have a film that the director looks at and then starts to work with for.
I shoot.
I can't even see all the dailies, because there's sometimes 3 hours of dailies, and until we've actually finished. And then I will sit down and see things for the first time and spend probably 2 months looking at the footage. And then getting into it.
Now, was Spinal Tap shot the
same way? Same way, yeah.
Where? How did you sort of concoct this way of making a movie? It seems very
well. Rob Reiner
unusual.
Directed that film. It was his first film. That came together in a somewhat different way. I had been playing in a band with Michael McKean since 67, 68. We started writing songs together and playing. And I've played music for a long time, and one of my old
what
music
was the band
old, one of my old partners is here, David Nickturn, who I've played a lot of music with. And we had a million names for bad names. That was the era of where anything that had a surreal kind of connotation was good. That was that strawberry alarm clock fudge thing, whatever.
Come on.
Well, our band was called Voltaire's Nose. Which, and when you're 19, that's funny. In 1968, we actually played the Village Vanguard for a George McGovern fundraiser, and we were introduced by Woody Allen, and that was about the high point of that. So Michael McKean and I had been playing music, and I had come up with this character, which eventually turned out to be the Nigel character, probably in the 70s. And that kind of somehow worked itself into. Then I was at the Chateau Marmont, a hotel in Los Angeles, and an English band was checking in. And I happened to be sitting in the lobby with a friend. And these guys walked in, and they were as close to the prototype of what this was to be. I don't know who they were, actually. doesn't matter. But they walked in and they were checking in, and the manager said to the one of these guys, and they had really long hair. It was a heavy metal band. He said, "Where's your bass?" And the guys, "My what?" He says, "Where's your bass?" He says, "I don't know. I think I left it at the airport." He says, "You left your bass at the airport?" "I don't know." This went on for 20 minutes. "You left your bass at the airport?" "I don't know. Maybe." And I was very glad to be there for that. And I have this, I guess, this affection for whatever that is. I don't know. I don't know what that is, but it's interesting to me. Anyway, this gave me the courage to kind of get towards wherever we ended up. And we wrote some songs. Harry Shearer, Michael McKean, and I wrote the music, and Rob helped with some of the lyrics. And we just said this style seemed to be a good way to do it. I don't know. It wasn't that well thought out. It was just a small movie. We didn't know it was going to still be around in a way, I guess. So.
And then you continued playing for a while Spinal Tap?
Well, we continue to play. In fact, we're playing Carnegie Hall in about 3 weeks. We're doing a show here. We're
Are
doing
you
it.
Serious?
I'm totally serious. Why would I? What a sad lie that would be. We thought there was going to be an actor and writer strike, so about months ago, we set some time aside to do a tour, and so we're doing L.A., we're playing the Greek Theater, we're playing in San Francisco, we're playing Carnegie Hall, Vegas, some other places. So, yeah.
Of the characters you've created, do you have a particular favorite? I know you've talked about how you begin with a voice often.
Well, that's the musical part of it. I think there are times where in the last film, in Best in Show, I heard this voice that I'd been, I mean, I don't mean in the Joan of Arc kind of way. I mean, I just came up with this voice. I've been doing this, I guess, since I was a kid. And if I hear that instrument, if that instrument is something I can play, then that I feel confident that I can do that. You know, it's like picking up a guitar and you just know, is this something you want to play? A great guitar, you don't want to put it down. Well, this voice, I would talk to myself. I'd drive around talking in this voice. And after a while, I thought, I think I can make this happen, you know. It doesn't always happen that way. But.
Mm-hmm. When you were working with the dogs in Bess and Cho, what was that like? Was that a...
Well, it was. First of all, if you've seen the film, it's about professional dog shows, essentially. And that world is very different than the pet world of... my dogs are just dogs. There's an intelligence test, not that this necessarily means that for show dogs, but there's an intelligence test that I read about, one of many steps in this test, where you take a dish towel and you put it on the dog's head and you see how long it takes for the dog to say, "I don't want this on my head." Well, not say verbally, obviously, but although that would be
that
a
would
smart
be
dog. And so I thought, well, I read that. I thought, this would be interesting. I have a dog, Henry. I said, "Henry, come here. Henry, come here." Okay. Second time he comes in. Thing on his head, he sat there. Good 5 minutes. And then he just started walking around with it on his head. Completely true, by the way. Completely true. And he just didn't mind, you know. And then I have another dog. I put it on this dog, Lucy, we have, and she flipped it off. And I thought, well, but what does that mean? I mean, who cares? He didn't mind that it was on his head, and she did. So this is a slightly diversion. Anyway, the dog world, in working with these real dogs, I had to cast champion dogs because they had to look like the dogs that are in shows as opposed to Hollywood trick dogs or pet dogs, obviously. So we shot this in Canada, and so there were Canadian champion dogs. And I had to audition dogs. So people brought their champion dogs in, and that became, it was like parents bringing in their kids and then me saying that I didn't want their kid. Their faces would fall, and I felt horrible. I thought, oh my, I can't do this. And it was not easy, and some of the people took it very personally and were very angry. And even to take it a step farther, in the most surreal thing that happened was during the shooting, I said to this woman, okay, so your dog's gonna come in second, you're third. She said, second? Are you crazy? This dog doesn't come in second. This is a champ. I said, no, this is a movie. This is a movie. You see, you're not an actor in the movie. You have a dog. This is the dog. And she didn't get it. I said, you can't come in first because you're not in the movie. You're not an actor in this is a movie. This is pretend. And for the next week, I see her brushing this dog and. So that was the world I was in.
Christopher Guest speaking with Susan Orlean earlier this summer at the New Yorker Festival. Since they spoke, Spinal Tap has wrapped up their summer tour. Their Carnegie Hall show was a sellout. The audience was treated to rousing versions of Break Like the Wind and Sex Farm and a Big Bottom finale. Coming up, Maureen Corrigan on the latest novel by John Irving. This is Fresh Air. The publication of John Irving's latest novel, The Fourth Hand, is one of this summer's major literary events. Book critic Maureen Corrigan gives it a thumbs down.
The first thing I noticed about John Irving's new novel, The Fourth Hand, is that it's in really bad taste. The plot revolves around a handsome New York television journalist named Patrick Wallingford, who, while he's reporting from India, has his hand gobbled up by a hungry circus lion. The gruesome amputation is witnessed on TV screens around the world, and one sympathetic viewer, a Wisconsin woman named Doris Clausen, decides a little too hastily to donate her still healthy husband's hand to Wallingford. Conveniently, Doris's husband soon dies in a bizarre accident involving a beer truck. But as a condition before she hands over the hand, Doris insists on having sex with Wallingford so that she'll finally become pregnant. It seems that for years, Doris's dearly departed husband was shooting blanks. Doris also demands post-operative visitation rights with her late husband's hand. The hand seems to nostalgically revel in these visits. Unlike horror films such as The Beast with Five Fingers, which have drawn on the same premise, Irving's novel seems to want us to be touched rather than repulsed by this hand with a mind of its own situation. Events become even more inane when Wallingford falls hopelessly in love with Doris, who after their one successful sexual encounter now only wants to hold hands. The next thing I realized is that, unusual for a novel by John Irving, I didn't care much about any of the characters. Patrick is a small-screen pretty boy who's all face, no substance. One of his many ex-lovers issues this parting estimation of his character. It's been flattering to be with a man who can so thoroughly lose himself in a woman, she says. On the other hand, there's so little you in you that I suspect you could lose yourself in any woman. Doris is a classic Irving Baroque who in this novel is asked to uncontort herself to fit the role of romantic heroine. The minor characters are fun, a Sex and the City type cast of newswomen, the renowned Boston hand surgeon with a dog poop fetish, but they're not in the company of any major players worth supporting. Here's the last thing that struck me about The Fourth Hand. I read the whole novel through, breathlessly, in a day or two. That's because Irving is such an adroit storyteller that even when he has a ridiculous story to tell, he does it with such humor, narrative flourish, and snake oil salesman conviction that he sweeps readers like me along. Irving keeps whisking out themes here that never quite cohere into one of his grand Dickensian narratives. He spends a lot of time ruminating on the exploitative nature of TV news. The CNN-type station Patrick reports for is dubbed the All Disaster Network, and we're treated to Irving's take on the coverage of events like JFK Jr.'s fatal plane crash. Irving also wants to engage more timeless questions, like the possibility of predestination and redemption through tragedy, but his reach exceeds his grasp, so to speak. Patrick's hand transplant ultimately fails, and the new hand, courtesy of Doris's late husband, has to be surgically removed. For a long time afterwards, Patrick experiences phantom limb syndrome, a tingling in his missing fingers, a twitch in a wrist that's no longer there. All the time I was reading The Fourth Hand, I felt like I was experiencing phantom novel syndrome. I had the ghostly sensation of being in the company of something like a John Irving novel. But whenever I looked closely at this story, it vanished into thin air.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Fourth Hand by John Irving. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Megan Howell, and Jessica Chu. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. For Terry Gross, I'm Peter Clowney.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of A Traitor to Memory by Elizabeth George, author of In Pursuit of the Proper Sinner. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, music and conversation with Rufus Wainwright. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
California, California, you're such a wonder that I think I'll stay. Big time rollers, part time models, so much to plunder that I think I'll sleep instead.